I got a little bit of snow last night. You guys did not get snow?
No, we got
rain. It's warm. It's actually warm here for December.
Like, oh.
Yeah, the snow is gone, thank God. The snow got all rained away yesterday.
Perfect. Well, we just got a little sprinkling. It looks like somebody just, like, sneezed into a bucket of flour, and it just kind of, like, landed everywhere. That's what our outside looks like.
A little flavor, a little bit of salt.
Yeah, yeah, it's cold. It's, I don't know, 30 now or something. Oh, it's going to get up to, you know, 40, 50. It'll be 60 in a couple of days. Which makes no sense.
Yeah, so it's going to be nice. Last week was so cold. It was unbelievable, at least where we are. And I'm doing a sawmill project. I'll go right into what I'm doing. I'm working on a sawmill. And yesterday it was warm, and it was the first day that it was warm, and it was perfect because I could be out at the sawmill, no ice. And I sliced up Rob, who now lives in
Costa Rica. You sliced up Rob? What?
That was bad phrasing. I sliced up a walnut tree that I got off of Rob's property from across the street. And he's in Poland. He's going to hear this and laughing. And I showed an Instagram story of me slicing up the tree. And then he calls me. He's like, is that the tree from my yard? And I was like, oh, why? Did you want it? I'm sorry. And he said, no. He thought the guy who cut it down is Eli, who I was just on the phone with. He thought Eli was going to take the whole thing for firewood. And so Rob was just surprised at how beautiful it came out. I mean, well, I didn't do anything. I just sliced it in half. And just the interior is just incredible. Mm. And it's just anybody would just assume it was a dead tree, nonsense-y tree, but that trunk, 8-foot trunk, it wasn't so big. And the diameter is probably 12 inches, so it's not huge at its thickest point. And it just looks incredible. And when you slice into nature, it just looks unbelievable. And so I got a warm day to play with my sawmill. So it's perfect. Nice. And now today it's pouring rain out. So.
It looks really cool. Like that sawmill look.
Oh, it's easy to use,
I guess. I don't know.
It is fairly easy to use. There's so much going on. You got to kind of like keep an eye on the motor, watch the bearings. And I remember when they offered it to me, they offered me one that you push. And when I went, I didn't know any better, but when I went to Lagersol in Sweden to see their machines up close, they have a new thing where you flip a switch and it just pushes through the log mechanically. And I'm like, oh, I wanted that. I want the mechanical one where you just stand at the controls. But in all honesty, after playing with the sawmill for a little bit, realizing you could feel the cut when you're holding the handle and knowing when you're either at a knot or potentially something inside the wood, like a nail or something, you could really feel that. And I feel if I just had that power switch just forcing it through, I might disengage the blade or jump the blade.
Okay, so my question is, if you can feel that, what does that cause? How do you do it differently if you feel that knot? Do you just slow down?
Yeah, you just slow the push. For me personally, I guess I'm still just learning how to use it. But as you're pushing on it, you feel a resistance. And I'm like, you think in your head, if I keep pushing, is the blade going to pop off? Can the blade pop off? I popped one blade, but that was only because my tension was way too low. It was totally my fault for not reading the instructions early enough. I was just eager to jump in. Pushing, you feel it. And I'm just watching the blade move. If the blade is still moving, I know that I'm not up against a bolt or a chain or something in the log. Because any log that's on somebody's front yard, which is what this one was, has susceptibility of having nails in it from a posted sign or even like a dog chain wrapped around it or something. So you got to really be careful. The sawmill down the block takes lumber from people's yards, but they won't take anything that's close to the house. They said mostly stuff close to the house or near the property line has barbed wire in it or anything. So, yeah. So it's interesting. They said they only take trees deep in properties, if anything at all, from like a private citizen.
Wow.
Because they can't run the risk of ruining a saw blade on a spike or something. You just feel that sensitivity, and then you just adjust accordingly. Go, Dave.
I have this slab. It's two pieces. I'm assuming it is like a book match slab. And my grandpa's friend, who I used to get wood from, I used to buy wood from him. And this tree had a chain wrapped around it all its life. Mm. So there's a part of it where you could see where the chain was wrapped around because it's misshapen. And he said, hey, if I give you these two slabs, will you make something out of this and just show it to me? Because I want to see what you can do. And I said, of course, I'll take it. And I think it's Douglas fir, but I'm not real positive. And then he passed away, and I never got to do that project to show him. And so these two slabs with these chain marks on there are still sitting in my shop waiting for me to do something. Yeah. There's a story there. So there's a video in there somewhere. And on my way to my mom's house, there's this tree that you could see decades ago at one time had a chain on it because it has that weird shape in the middle. Hourglass. And if I ever make this video, I'm going to try to secretly go to this tree and film it to show what it could have looked like.
Yeah, that's cool.
Yeah.
You should go ahead and get that shot before...
Yeah,
that tree falls
right.
down.
You're right.
And then you're like, wait a minute. Two things in the way of making this video.
Yeah.
What's incredible, though, is every time you slice through a piece of tree like that, I've done it twice now. This is the second time I've done it. You slice through and you look at it and just like, you immediately think you could just like lean it on the house and put it up for sale. It's just, the potential is amazing because you slice through. Well, you could imagine what Matt Cremona goes through. He's been making these slabs for years now. Mm-hmm. But you pull one of these slabs up and you're just like, whoa. It's like money.
As soon as I saw your video of that thing laid out, I was like, oh, I know somebody who can cut slabs now. Cool. I mean, the truth is, I know a lot of people who can do that, but I'm like, I could actually go up and get a slab from Jimmy to make something out of. Like, that's awesome.
Yeah, yeah. It's cool. I'm really looking forward to the spring when it's not quite as cold and murky out, but it's there. It starts right up. Just it's amazing. And then the tractor was a huge help, having the tractor and... Wood is so unbelievably heavy. In fact, the original intention, I'm going to make a bench, a park bench with a back and a seat for to put outside the new horse barn. And it's going to be some blacksmithing and metalwork involved. I was going to just cut the slab. I was just going to cut the tree in half and have half a tree up and half a tree down. So it looks sort of like a national park kind of bench. And it was so heavy, we couldn't even move it. I was like, forget it. Let's not do that. We didn't get the log itself was that's probably 1,000 pounds or more, so we'd be moving 2 500-pound pieces. So I said, forget it. Let's just cut it. We cut it 1 into a 3-inch slab for the back and a 4-inch slab for the bottom, and I saved a couple of layers, a couple of skinny slabs to lean on the building. So that's in today and tomorrow. I'll be getting into the metalwork to make legs, and I'm gonna do the sort of medieval blacksmithy looking thing. So that's what I'm gonna do.
Medieval blacksmithy looking thing.
Cool. Yeah.
Got it.
And I'm going to leave the bark on it just to get everybody mad at me.
Oh, yeah. You know, it's funny. People do get mad about that. And years ago, like probably 2015 or so, I made this this little bench out of half of a tree chunk that my grandfather gave me. And I like cut off a slab of it and then hollowed out the inside. So it looks like half of a log, but there's a secret compartment on the inside of it. It's got steel legs. I left the bark on the entire underside of this thing, and people were very upset about it, telling me how it was going to fall off and how, I don't know why that's like a huge deal, but anyway, they were upset about it. That was a long, long time ago, and that thing is sitting in my living room right next to the back door. Every single piece of bark is still on.
Yeah.
Like, I'm sure it will fall off eventually. I get it, but...
But I was trying to think how to combat that, and I have a 15-gauge nailer, and I was just going to whack the bark full of 15-gauge nails on the video just to keep them from falling off. It might dry and shrink and make it fall away, but it's not going to fall off.
Yeah.
So I might just whack the bark full of nails. You won't see it because they'll all get buried. So I might do that for fun, just to get the goat of the fans.
Yeah. You could take the bark off and then glue it back on with epoxy.
Oh, man.
But I don't have that kind of time. I got to be done right. This weekend.
That would be awesome.
I'm even going to paint the... It's sitting out... It's in the barn right now near the heated floor. Not on the heated floor, but on horses. So I'm sure the barn is going to at least dry the surface water. Yeah. Certainly is going to shrink and change shape. But I'm going to have this finished in the next 4 days. So I don't care what anybody thinks. It's getting done.
Mm.
So it's just I'm making these steel straps that are going to hold the slabs. So they're going to be trapped in these two spots. And yeah, each slab will be trapped in two spots and then welded together. So it'll be a seat and a back, steel legs, so on and so on. I have a loose sketch in my head.
Cool. Yeah. Cool, cool. David, what have you been doing?
This week, I am working on a, I guess the best way to phrase it is a sculptural wine rack. Like, it could live as a piece of art without holding wine bottles. But it's, so it's basically, it's got 10 cubbies for 10 wine bottles. And each cubby is a hexagon. So there's 6 pieces for each one. And then it starts at the floor and does like a little S-curve on the way up. And so it's about 40-some inches tall. And it's got a big, heavy base. So it's because it's kind of skinny and tall. So it needs something to keep it from tipping over. All out of solid cherry. And it came out... I'm making the base today. And so far it is coming out better than I thought. Like, you sketch something up and you don't know if it's going to be as cool as you think it is, and then when you see it in person, you're like, yep, that was way cooler than what I thought it was. And this is one of those projects. Yeah,
nice.
So it was it's a shorter video because it's making 60 pieces and they're all the same thing. And so, like, how do you turn it? So it's a pretty quick video because it's all the 90% of the video is just making the same one side of the hexagon and then gluing them all up and making them into this form. I did have to cut like a plywood template, and so as I'm stacking them together, I made this plywood S curve template where I could push up the box against that and get that curve the way I wanted it, and you know, came out really good, or it's coming out really good. I guess there's still time for it to fail. there's always time for it to fail.
That's funny.
It's not done until it's done.
It's not done until it's done. Yeah,
I'm about to run into the same thing with the kind of repetitive cut thing. I'm working on the next project will be kind of some sound treatment stuff for my office in. I have to make 46 of these pieces that are pretty simple, but they're the same thing. And the end result will be a little bit more complicated, but I'm in the same place where I'm trying to figure out, like, how do I do super repetitive work, a whole bunch of it, and make that interesting? And then is there something that I can do to the repetitive pieces to make them a little bit more unique without tripling the amount of time that I have to spend because there's so many, you know. So it's like a weird trade-off of needs to be interesting, but maybe not too interesting.
Right.
So. But, yeah, that's actually what I'm about to start on. I started already. I did this new desk. I know I told you guys about the desk. I don't know if we talked about it on the show. But I built a new desk for my office, and I absolutely love it. It's great. But part of the reason for that was so I could start recording music again, writing and recording. And so since I'm redoing the office to kind of help with that, I figured I should go ahead and do some audio treatment. So I'm doing some baffling and some diffusers and bass trap up in the corner and different things like that. So I'm working on that stuff. I'm trying to figure out how to make it interesting. And it's funny because I have a long history with music, but I don't really have a lot of history with like audio, room audio, but how to do it well and how to make rooms good for recording. And so I just decided this video is going to be about me not understanding like the physics and the necessary parts of it. I'm just taking other people's word for it. And I'm going to make some things that other people say you need to see if it makes the room better, you know?
Yeah.
Because I decided, like, I can either spend a week understanding it completely and, like, learning all the stuff and then have to make something, or I can just assume that other people know what they're talking about and make what they make and see if it, you know, improves my basement room that I'm calling a studio.
The custom desk thing is, I have a custom desk that I'm sitting at right now, and it works... It fills 90% of my needs, but there's this 10% that it could be better. And so I want to redo, actually I want to make this desk go, to each wall. This is a really small room. And I've been taking mental notes on how I'm going to do that. And I don't know, like when I first got started in woodworking, one of the first things that you build is a bench. And when you read the books and you watch the professionals, they're like, you build your first bench and then you realize what you actually need for a bench, and then you'll build another bench. And then maybe that bench will last you a lifetime, or maybe your needs will change and you'll build another bench. And that's the same thing with my desk. My needs change. This could be more efficient. This could be like, it's my brain likes a nice clean look, and it's kind of sloppy with the way things are set up. So I don't know when I'm going to do that, but I'll probably do a two video series, one where I make the desk in here and another one where I actually finish the drywall on this other wall and kind of do some shelves and everything. And it looks good from your perspective, but there's drywall over here. You can see all the screws. It's not been mudded or whatever you call that. The door over here doesn't have the frame around it, so you can see all the innards of the wall. It's been unfinished for 2 years.
Just graffiti the wall. Just get a graffiti artist to come in and paint over it, and then you don't have to worry about mud or any of that stuff.
That would be awesome. Yes.
Yeah. It would look cool. Cool. Yeah, I mean, I think this desk may not be like the last desk I ever make or anything, but it's a big improvement on, I don't know, having like some structure. Having structure, not physical structure, structure to what I plan to use the space for, you know, and having that structure there is helping me be more aware of like the things that I set on the desk and the things that are plugged in, hanging out of all of the devices. You know, I don't want it to just have a bunch of wires coming out of it. So I've had to think a little bit more about, oh, wait, I see that fly. There's been a fruit fly.
Yes.
Oh, I missed it. Sorry, no. There's going to be loud claps throughout this episode as I try
to kill
this.
You're 0 for 5.
Yeah, I'm doing terrible at this, but I will get him. So, you know, it's made me more aware of keeping it like it is now. I want it to be an efficient, kind of nice-looking space, unlike the picture that Jimmy just sent us.
I just sent you guys a picture of my desk. It's a roll-top desk that I bought at an antique shop for $100 because it was broken. Something was broken on it.
Yeah.
So I bought it for $100. I actually was with Habu and Jenny Swiss when I bought it about 4 years ago, 5 years ago. And we were at an antique shop, and I grabbed it, and it's been my desk ever since. It's a roll-top desk, and it's got a million cubbies and stuff. And every time I open a drawer, I go, oh, that's where I put that. Every single time. All the cubbies are filled with something. And then on top of it is a vintage woodworker's toolbox. It's from the turn of the century. I bought it at a local antique shop. And that costs three times more than the desk.
Right.
But it's all just full of junk and tools and everything.
So Jimmy's desk has the two pull out slides to expand your desk, and he has them both pulled out, so it looks like he is the captain of a spaceship because it kind of surrounds him.
You see these? You see those? My elbows? They're both sitting on each one of
those. It's that small.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And then each one of the slide outs has every password I've ever needed written on.
Noted.
Is that what that paper is on the side? Is that a list of passwords? Yeah. Oh my gosh.
That's your password manager?
Jimmy.
Yeah, that's my password manager, is that white piece of paper on the side. Oh, it's got probably 30 passwords on it from different things and accounts.
And Bob's shaking his head.
Jimmy. Grandpa Jimmy.
I don't want to be morbid. Grandpa, I'm going to be morbid for a second, but since my dad passed away, we have no idea how to get into anything because he never left passwords anywhere. So my sister would be my executor if I decided to exit earlier than her. And I always tell her, I said, everything you need is written on my desktop. Everything you need. So she can get into my computer, then get into anything if she doesn't know all the little details. So it's morbid, but that's the story in case
that's reality. The way it goes. I got asked the other day, Apple sent me a message and said, like, just making sure you still have your legacy contact in place. And I'm like, oh, that's what they're calling that.
I had that set up. I had that set up in a previous life, and I had to undo it, for a previous person. But it's important to get that set up. Because my sister was able to have my – she has my dad's phone. So for like 6-8 months, you would always answer the calls and tell whoever was looking for him if it was a personal friend. Most of the time, it's just junk. But she's like, yep, this is Joe's phone, and he's no longer alive, just in case you needed him.
Yeah.
So
I think, like, I know I harp on, I'm joking with you, you do it however you want to do it, but I know I harp on the password manager thing, but actually that's one of the reasons that I care so much about it, is because Jenny has to know literally one password, and then she can get into everything else. So if something were to happen to me, she knows that one, and that's all she has to care about. And, I, you know, no matter which one you use, that idea that it's all recorded and kind of easy to get through, because I can imagine, man, I don't know how we got here, but I can imagine that if I were, you know, if something happened to me, her world and the kids' world is going to be chaos for a long time. Like that just throws everything upside down. And there's so many things to figure out when you lose somebody like that, that having then also to figure out how to get into the bank account and how to pay the so-and-so bill and how to, you know,
my dad has two cars sitting in the driveway. Nobody could find the keys for months. We found them, ultimately, but they weren't just like hanging up on the hook where there was 40 other keys. None of those other keys had anything to do with anything we could figure out. So it's just little things like that. Like I said to when my brother was living here for a minute a couple summers ago, I said, this yellow pouch has keys to every car. I got 15 cars, and like all the keys, extra keys, are in this yellow pouch. He's like, okay, it's good to know. Just because that we were going through at the time, I said to him, you know, the fact that we don't know where any of my father's titles are. The house is almost 90% cleaned out. I don't think my sister found any of the titles to any of the vehicles. Like we might have thrown them out because they were wrapped up in something else. But you know, this is all stuff you just take for granted. You just assume it's never going to be needed, or at least by somebody different than you.
Yeah. If I know where it is, then I can find it. But
yeah,
if that's in your head, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, we have like a little kind of firebox. It's not a safe. I mean, it's like a lock box, but it's like fire protected box. And so all of the birth certificates and social security cards and marriage license and all of those kind of official documents are in there, just so that they're protected, but also they're in one place. So at least either one of us would know where to go for all that type of stuff. But anyway.
So my desk is just basically my password holder. And you know how many times this is, I have to really be careful. You know how many times I've done like a story at my desk?
I thought of that as soon as I said, is that paper full of your passwords? That was the first thing I
can't
even
read them from where I'm looking right here. And I'm like 20 inches away after I wrote it all really small. But that's not why I wrote it small, just so I could fit a lot of them on is why I wrote it small. But there have been times where I've done screen grabs and Instagram stories, and I've like given away all my bank information.
Gosh.
Yeah.
I get fans, they write, they're like, is this important, this information, like in a screen grab with a circle line? I'm like, oh my God, you're right. And I have to go back and delete the story.
Yeah, I've done that
more than a few times. I've done it like 5 times, maybe more.
I found my old college ID, and I posted it online, and it had my social security number on there. I'm like, what stupid college put your social security number on your college ID?
Wow.
Yeah.
Years ago, I was so... and
got deleted.
I was so proud to show when I very first started learning Fusion. I was at Mike Dubnow's house. He's the millionaire machinist that Jocko did a story on. I was at his place, and he's giving me my first lesson on Fusion, and I built an ice pick. I remember I built an ice pick in Fusion, and he gave me all the lessons and everything. And I was like, look at this, and I showed it. And then I got an email about 20 minutes later from somebody. It's like, hey, you just showed your iCloud password, and I know it's your iCloud password because I just got into your iCloud. He goes, you can trust me. He goes, and it was somebody I vaguely knew that I've emailed in the past. He goes, change it right away. He goes, I just had to just check and see if that's what it was. He goes, and it was. He goes, I immediately logged out. He goes, change it right now. It's like, oh my God. And I did, and I changed it.
Crazy. Be careful out there, people.
Yeah. Don't give you. If you forget your iCloud password now, you might as well, you just have to start a new one. There's no like recovery system. Is there any more for iCloud?
Yes, there is. Yes, only you would just decide to like nuke it and start over.
I just get a new computer.
There is a way to get.
By the way, look at the picture I sent you. My other computer is right underneath this one. It's probably exactly how it's going to sit for the next 3 years.
it's literally underneath the laptop.
A computer on a computer.
Yeah.
Yeah,
it's that's like a lot of drives too.
Yeah,
you know, those are, I was backing those up to my Synology, and I kind of got sidetracked. Those are the ones that aren't backed up yet. I have to go through them. As they get backed up, they get put into a box.
This reminds me of the 80s. In the 70s, everybody had the big console TV that sat on the floor, and eventually those big pieces died, but it was a piece of furniture. So when you got a new TV in the 80s, you just set it on top of the old console TV.
Yes. That's right.
Yeah.
That's funny.
Yep.
So, David, you had we were talking before we started recording, and you had kind of an idea for
the topic. So I realized I edit my videos in Final Cut Pro. I think I'm pretty darn efficient at it. And the faster I get at it, the more the fancier I get with my edits and the more I want to do with the edits. So even though I get better at this thing, I still fill up the same amount of time. And we were trying to figure out a way to phrase this in a sentence. And I think I got it. The more efficient I get, the more creative I become. So I end up using the same amount of time.
Mm. Right. And you have more time to play.
I have more time to play.
Yeah.
And yeah. I don't know if this is a good thing or a bad thing because we're always trying to save time.
I think it's whether you want that or not. That's right. It's not necessarily good or bad. Yeah.
No, you know, it's funny. I never stopped to think about that, but I have that a lot where I get my job done fast and then I have time to either fix an emergency or play or tinker in that same arena. So, for instance, yesterday I did not plan, and this is a good example, because of the weather, I planned on picking the log up with help from Eli and Mike, putting the log on the truck, getting the sawmill loaded, and then that would have been enough because I had a Zoom call to do and I would have had to stop in the middle of the day. But we got everything over there. I was able to slice the log up. I thought I was going to be over there at the sawmill today slicing up. So I got so much more done before my 2 o'clock meeting than I ever expected. I still had time to spare, get home, and put on clean clothes for my Zoom meeting because I was covered with sawdust from the sawmill. And that was nice. So I really had planned to not even get nearly that far in that day. And so that happens a lot too, especially on the computer. Like, I think I have so much to do, I sit and I throw it all in, tweak it, speed it up, slow it down, and then I'm like, oh, that was only 15 minutes, that's done. And I have been playing with Final Cut Pro now too, so I've been digging into some of the menus and learning how to use some of the stuff.
Yeah, I think, you know, I'm making this wine rack now, and since it's all the same stuff, I know how to be very efficient with it. I got 60 pieces to make. They're all exactly the same. I know exactly what to do. And this took me a little over a day. If I was doing this 10 years ago, 12 years ago, it probably would have taken me 2 or 3 days because I would have been like, let me make sure my blade is set up right. I need to do a test and I don't know the most efficient and safe way to do this. And so it does allow me to be, I can get past the mundane stuff so I can focus on being creative and doing the cool things. I think this applies to a lot of things. I remember my first job out of college was with this newspaper. And my job was to develop the film in the morning, scan the negatives, and then do all the Photoshop stuff for the newspaper of these images, and then also get ready for the next day. I got so good at my job, I was done by 12:30 every single day, and so I still had another 3 hours to do whatever I wanted. So that started my freelance career of working on websites and doing my own personal stuff while at work. Nobody really knew that I was done by 12:30 every day, but I did.
They do now.
Yeah,
they didn't have to.
Yeah. So, I mean, that efficiency is a good thing in that you're buying yourself time. Like, your experience is buying yourself time. But then, I guess the question or the potential bad side of that is what we were talking about before we started recording, is that extra time that you then bought yourself doesn't necessarily get put where you want it to be put.
Right.
You're putting it back into the same amount of output. It's just better output.
Yeah.
the same number of videos, but better videos, which is totally fine if that's what you're going for. But that you're that margin that you're buying yourself, deciding how you want to use that, I think is pretty necessary. Otherwise, it will be, what is it, Parkinson's law, that like a job will take the amount of time that you give it or something like that. There's one of those. And you made the reference of like a goldfish.
It feels, whatever size the fishbowl it's in, you're going to grow, that goldfish is going to fill that aquarium. And I think a lot of times the reason I get efficient at something, whether it's software or actually making something, is like, I can do this faster, so I can get done faster, so I can have more time to do personal things. And I think that's always the goal. And that, but I still fill up the fishbowl with the actual job. So I think I go in thinking this is going to give me more personal time, but then it ends up being just more creative time, which is still a net positive.
No, I like that. I always love when I have an extra day on a project, for instance. I would look at that window of opportunity and say, what can I do now that I didn't think I was going to be able to do? What can I fill this void with that's potentially a new product or a new design or a new something around that? I think I made that conscious decision to be like, I have this block of time. Everyone thinks I'm stuck doing the podcast, but we have the day off. Well, how can I use this secret 3 hours for myself to do something cool?
It's pretty rare that I finish a project, anything, whether it's music or woodworking or whatever, and there wasn't something that could have been done better or fixed or improved upon. Like, you always have to say, we're done, we're moving on to the next thing. But if you give yourself a little bit more time, you could in theory go back and fix that little thing or add that little thing. One of the struggles I always have is like, I look at all my old projects, I'm like, dang it, I could have done that a little bit better.
Yeah, but at that point, I mean, this is a general thing, but it feels like for me, when I'm at that point, there's diminishing returns on that last little 10% of, I could go back and tweak a little thing, but how much of a difference is it actually going to make to the entire thing? Is it worth that continued investment into that thing that ultimately maybe nobody else will even notice, versus taking that 10% and using it for something entirely different, or, getting started on the next thing? I think the big problem that I have is when I get, I went from 4 videos, I used to make videos every week, went from that to 2 a month, and like maybe 1 a month. That's just the thing that I've set up for myself. And the intent wasn't to then make videos that are twice as big to fit in that amount of time, so that I'm still working the same amount of time with half the output. The goal was half the output, half the effort, and then I've got half my life that I can do whatever I want to. Like, that was the goal, right?
I like that.
But I still go, well, yeah, but I got 2 more weeks. Like, I can just go ahead and like spend a day thinking or spend a day whatevering, and so I end up using a lot of that time that was supposed to be for non-work life, everything else, I end up using it for, I don't know, less efficient work, I guess. Like, it's still work, but it's not actually moving the things along a little bit. And so I struggle with that. But at the same time, the flip side of that is that I get to have a day to think. Like, yesterday, I was working on this sound treatment thing that I mentioned before. A year ago me would have been like, all right, I'm going to sit down, I'm going to draw something, and I'm going to start making it. And the first idea is the idea that we're going with, because that's the amount of time that I have. And that's what we're going to do. Yesterday, I walked circles in my shop for easily 3 hours. And it was just like, well, I could do it this way. I'm going to sketch something up on the whiteboard. And I'm like, well, let's walk around for a little bit longer. So I walked circles around the shop for a little while. I'm like, oh, here's another idea. I could do this. And it was really, really nice to have that
free time,
lower stakes work time. It was still work time, but it wasn't like, it didn't have to matter a whole lot. You know what I mean? It was
on the other side, margin. Though, it's also nice to just get an idea and just go with it.
Sure, absolutely. And like, I feel better about that because I feel like I'm using my time better.
Right.
But I will say that it was nice to be able to have ideas and be like, no, that's not good enough. I can do better. You know, because I don't really do that as much as I should.
This whole conflict comes down to one person in my life, and that is Dr. Jones. He was the head of the graphics department at college. Did you miss it?
Again? I missed it. Sorry.
0-6. Yeah. And it was like the last 10% is 90% of the project. He drilled into us that the details matter, the presentation matters. Mm-hmm. You are not being graded on your actual graphic design work that you're turning in. You're being graded on the presentation, the effort, and the details. And so that has just always been with me. The details matter. The details is what separates a good graphic designer from a bad one. And I'm not saying I'm a good graphic designer. I learned pretty quick when I got a job that I was not the best graphic designer in the house. But to me, to this day, the details matter. The last 10% is 90%.
Yeah, I always thought that as well by one of my very influential teachers. Presentation is everything. And you could make something look really good that's not very good, and you can make something look really bad that's actually really good. So yes. you really gotta be conscientious and know what it is you're showing and how you're showing it. And I try and remember that as often as possible. Like, I'll tape a box up and look back at it and go, if I got this box, I would think I bought a carburetor on eBay. You know what? Let me go back and like, I'll cut the box open and then find the cleaner box. Or just lately, I've been just making my own boxes. And presentation is everything. And sometimes I make a box out of something else and fold the graphic inside. So they get a cardboard box and they open it up and it's a box from something else. And they go, oh, that's cool. Because I recycled it, you know. So God will remember me.
I wonder if that's one of the differences between... Okay, so we've had this conversation many times where, you know, you guys both are artists, and you know that you are artists. You call yourself artists, and I don't. I just don't feel that way about myself. I'm not pulling that up again. One of the differences that I just realized is that you all have that goal of that last bit of presentation, those details. Forby has that too, because he and I, and he's an artist, we have these conversations about how things look or whatever, and he has that finesse, that visual additional little sparkle thing that makes it really good. Whereas my natural inclination is it needs to work, it needs to do the thing that it was made to do, and then I can move on and make the next thing do the thing that it's made to do. And those aren't necessarily really at odds. They are not necessarily artistic or not artistic. They are detail-oriented. But I think that might be one of the things that I never really consciously thought about being different between the two of you and me. And maybe it's kind of connected to the art, not art label or whatever. Because I definitely have to make myself do that extra layer of visual. And that's actually part of what I was doing yesterday when I was walking circles around in the shop. It's like, I can make a diffuser for audio. It's just like sticks. I can do that. That's no big deal. But if I take the time, maybe I can find a way to make it interesting. If I take a little more time, maybe I can find a way to make it, you know, extra. It's like plussed up. It has an extra detail or has an extra thing. And that kind of additional work is what I typically have not let myself have time for. So... Mm-hmm. Maybe I'm growing. I don't know. Maybe I just have more time.
Can I just to clarify, I know it's 10 years and I don't think we've ever actually done this. Can we each qualify what we went to college for specifically?
Yeah.
I'll go first.
Yeah.
Oh, I went to the School of Visual Arts and I was going in as a graphic designer. I thought I'd graduate with a graphic design degree. And I must confess, looking back, I had no idea what exactly a graphic designer was. It's just I had my guidance counselors around me saying, you should become a graphic designer. You're an artist. Become a graphic designer. I didn't know what it meant. So until I got into college, I was like deep into my first year when I realized what graphic design meant. I just knew that it was commercial art, that somehow it involved package design and logos and stuff. But it became much more clear to me. And then I met a teacher that got me into 3D. So I did graduate a BFA in the graphic design department, but I graduated with a 3D illustration portfolio. And that teacher is Kevin, who I've talked about before. Kevin got me involved in three-dimensional design, and then I met another guy who was very influential in my life, Mark. And Mark introduced me to the toy business just as I was graduating. So those two were the big influences on my life. So I didn't graduate as a graphic designer per se, but as basically a product designer. I wasn't in that department, but I did graduate like that.
Mine was is called visual communications, which is basically, it's just graphic design. It's just speaking through images and words laid out on paper or whatever you're using. And I picked visual communications because I thought it sounded cool. I was working, so after I graduated high school, I had no plans of going to college. None whatsoever. I hated school.
I graduated high school and I took a year. I didn't know what to do. I just worked at the sign shop.
And I got a job at a factory. I hated that. So I only worked there for like a month. And then I went to Kmart. And I think of about 3 or 4 years into that, I'm like, you know what? I don't want to work at Kmart for the rest of my life. I should go to school. And I just thought, well, all my friends are, I just surrounded myself with creative people, whether they're artists or musicians or whatever. And I thought graphic design sounded like maybe this is the right thing. I didn't have a passion for it. And then when I started, I realized I've always paid attention to logos, to way things look. I realized I did have a passion for it. I just didn't know it. Like
you
could
have a window on it.
Yeah. I could draw the Shell gas station logo without looking at it because I would stare at these things as a kid, and that led to, you know, right out of college, I didn't get a graphic design job, but I did get to work basically in a photo studio. And while working there, I met somebody who had a recording studio. So I ended up being the shadow of an audio engineer there for a year and got to do some audio recording in a professional studio. That studio owner was also a photographer, so I got to do assistant wedding photography. And then I eventually got a job as a graphic designer, but I wasn't as good as the other graphic designers, so I kind of got pushed into web design, which I was just studying on my own in my free time, learning how to do that. And then it all just kind of took off. Yeah, so to answer your question, visual communications.
Very cool.
So I went to Savannah College of Art and Design, and I actually started the exact same way as you, Jimmy. It was kind of weird that you were saying that, because I went in for graphic design not really knowing what it was. And, I mean, I knew it was computer-related design
stuff.
See,
I'm so old, computers weren't even in the school when I went
there. This was 10 years after you
started. The only computers are in the bursar's office with green letters on them.
Also, I go to the to this first, I've probably told this before, but I go to that first graphic design 101 class, and first day this guy named Steve was like, no computers, doing it all by hand. I'm like, oh man, this is not what I wanted. And I immediately then understood why he was doing that throughout the course, but also was like, yeah, this is not really my skill set, this is not where the area that I want to be in. So I moved into what was called computer art, and it was just a general computer-based art degree. And so, you know, 3D design, 2D animation, video work, audio work, it was all of those arts that are through the computer. And so it was a really broad, degree, but it was a BFA as well. So
the cool thing about when I was in school is it was more than just graphic design. There was also photography and advanced photography classes. And there was also a screen printing class and then a life drawing class. So all of those, I got to do all of those things. And when I started my YouTube channel, it felt like I got to continue doing all of those things. You know, I made a 100%. Couple screen printing videos and I'd done some photography and I still do some photography.
Everything came together for me on YouTube. Yeah. Everything I've ever learned, and that's why I love it the most. But to bring it back to the topic, I always remember when I was a student, I had stopped drinking right when I started college, so I had lots of free time when everybody was out partying and learning how to use drugs and doing stuff. I was completely sober. I didn't really go to parties. I had all my homework done, way ahead of schedule. So I spent a lot of time in the lab just playing while everybody was frantically trying to get their homework done right up until the last minute. I'm not saying I was the only one. There were other students who were way ahead of the curve. But for me, I got a lot of time to experiment and play because I always got all my work done fast. And I learned I would go to the cage and ask Maurice, like, how do I make a photostat? And what do I do with this? And what is that? I just had a lot of time to just dilly-dally and play and learn from people that were ahead of me because I got all my work done fast. And it goes back to kind of what we're talking about. I used that time to my advantage. And by the time I was done my 4 years, a lot of my fellow students were like, how do you know how to do this? How do you know how to do that? It's like, I guess it could contribute it most often to just not spending 50% of my time being drunk and high. In Manhattan in the 80s, you know, everybody, it's like, I remember this one time, and I might have told you guys this story. I remember one time we were all sitting around at lunch, and this one cooler older girl, you know, if we were like 19, she was probably 22, like went back to college again. She's like, who's going to see the Chili Peppers this weekend? And like five people like, I'm going. And in my mind, I'm like, Chili Peppers. I don't know what that means. And then they told some story about how they're naked on stage with socks, and I'm like, I don't know who they are. I've never heard of them.
I'm like, I don't know anybody. Sound like something I want to go to.
I wish I had a phone in my hand so I could Google who are the Chili Peppers.
You reminded me of, I remember like when you, it took so long to get all your classes and the times right so you could make efficient use of your day and so you could go home to do work or drugs or whatever you wanted to do in your free time. And it didn't always work out where you could have one class back to back to back. So when you're on campus, there would be downtimes. And I spent that downtime in the dark room or in the art room, just using all the stuff. And now I just now realized how important that was because I'm just doing stuff.
Yeah, no, for instance, I was in Manhattan, so it'd be like, you know what, I got an hour to kill for my next class, let me go down and see that gallery show that's in the main building, because school had like five buildings. So let me go to the 21st Street West Side building and see what's going on in the lobby, because they always had really cool stuff. Or let me go to the West 17th Street building to see what's going on in the lobby, because that's the fine art building. So I would take my opportunities to go fill it with just inspiration. And then just being in Manhattan, like, oh, let me go check out that cool. I remember there was a shop way uptown. I remember one time I took the subway way uptown to go to Maxible and Mandible, which was a store that I had only heard about that sold human bones and skeletons of humans and animals alike. And it was basically a science store. You would have been a medical student to go there and buy stuff. And I remember going there and like walking in and the guy's like, you're not from NYU medical. I'm like, no, I'm an art student. And he said art students come in, but I couldn't afford anything, you know, skulls and bones for hundreds of dollars. But I just got to look through the window cases.
I was going to jump back. You talked about the variation of classes that you had to take, David. And I think, you know, I had to take a bunch of art history, a bunch of life drawing, color theory, you know, 2D animation classes that were, it seemed totally useless at the time. But I think those type of, they were called foundations for us. Those foundations classes, everybody had to take for the first 2 years.
Yep.
And those were some of the most far reaching classes that I took at any level of school, because especially color theory, like I dreaded
that going was one of the first classes I took, and I didn't get it at all. But now I
can understand. It was huge for me. Just to I don't know why it made such an impact, but that has been a really big part of just my understanding of what I see in the world. And I think you know, the life drawing and the still life drawing, all that stuff was really beneficial. Even though I'm not much of a drawer, you know, and I don't use that on a regular basis. Being able to translate something to paper in the way that, you know, like I think you and I both sketched a similar way, Jimmy, in the getting an idea down in wireframe and stuff. And that stuff was huge. The other part that was really, I think, beneficial to me in art school was being surrounded by, it wasn't a graphic design school. It was an art school. So I was surrounded by people who like were super film nerds and were super sculpture people and fibers people, and just like not the passive, like I kind of like movies person, the like hardcore film nerd people.
The fourth floor at the School of Visual Arts smelled like patchouli, and all everybody ever did talk about was all everybody talked about was raising money for their final film. That's all they talked about in the you'd hear kids talking about, oh, my dad's going to give me $5,000, my uncle's going to give me $1,000, I think my other uncle's going to give me $2,000. Like, that's so all they talked about was raising $10,000 or $15,000 to make a film.
I had to take some film classes, and like, you know, you take at the time we were shooting on 16, and we had we'd Super 8 cameras and stuff like that. But there was this guy named Jonathan Green. I don't know where Jonathan is. I would love to catch up with Jonathan now because I'm sure he's probably in Hollywood making amazing things. I don't know where he is, but somehow I met Jonathan and ended up hanging out with him for like 6 months, a year. We spent a whole lot of time together in a short amount of time, and he was like one of those film guys. And his house was this old Savannah house that he rented. He had sheets over all the windows on the inside, so the entire thing was dark. And he would go to some sort of school supply place and buy big reels of film from like school educational movies and stuff. And he had all these projectors, and he had sheets up on the wall, and we would all go hang out at his house and just grab film and cut it. And we would cut together these pieces and scratch the film and then project it on the wall.
Oh,
and
that's
everybody
cool.
would just like, while we're hanging out, we're just like making little experimental strips of stuff. Like, why would you do that? I don't know. But man, we had a blast, and I learned so much about
splicing.
It doesn't have to look good. It's an experiment. Like, the end result was not something would ever... It would go in the garbage, you know, immediately. But it was like
TikTok
playing
video now.
Playing in a medium that I had no business being in and had no interest in following. But like, knowing him showed me a whole bunch of different stuff, and that was just one person. You know, there were tons of people in that environment that were just super passionate about these things that I would just get exposed to, and I would learn a little bit about. And so, yeah, YouTube is like the place where all of those weird experiences that you had in art school get to come together. And you're like, oh, yeah, I can kind of use the color theory and the 3D design and the this and the that together. You
know? Yeah.
When
film
I needed...
students were very passionate. That's definitely one thing I came across back then. I'm like, how could you be this age and spend half your time drunk and high and still have such passion about knowing how to get your
own? That was dressed really cool, too.
Yes. Go ahead, Dave.
When I needed the money, I ended up selling all my textbooks, and I wish I would have kept them all. And a year or so ago, I found the color reference book that we had in college. I don't know if you had this particular book at all, but I still wish I had my typography books. And if I ever see my typography book that I had, I would buy it again. I remember exactly what all the books look like. Like, I can picture my life drawing book, you know, like they were, you had them with you every day and you were a big part. And I didn't realize it then, but I know now that I would stare at these layouts, and I don't know if studying's not the right word, but I would just absorb the colors and the layout of these books. Bob is looking for something.
Yeah, this was, we didn't have a color theory book. We had this compass, and it was,
I have a few of those.
You know, it's just a book. I guess it is a book, but it's mostly just like layouts of all of the different wheels and, you know, combination stuff. And I found this in a box the other day or on a shelf or something, and looking through it, was immediately taken back to college. I'm like, oh, that's where I learned that thing.
Yeah.
Or that's why I look at, you know, color associations that way, because of how that thing looked.
Right.
Stuff like that. It's pretty cool. Anyway.
Do kids still get textbooks, or is everything on tablets now?
My kids don't get textbooks in school. I don't know about in college, but in high school, it's all on a Chromebook. Hmm. Do everything there, which is kind of weird. So back to the original thing. As we become better at stuff, we kind of buy ourselves some time, some margin. Has that worked against you, or is it just something you've noticed?
I think it's, for me, it's just something I've noticed. I think it's worked for me. It just allows me to be a little bit more creative, allow the massaging and fine tuning of things at the very end to be just a little bit better.
It's my cherished time. I always, like I said, I've said it before, I say it today, it's always nice to have a couple of hours at the end of, even if it's a project for a client or anything, just to really sit back and look and say, if as an example for me is if I, and it's what Dave said, if I get my edit done early on, for instance, on a Saturday night for a post on Sunday morning, if I'm done by 5 o'clock in the afternoon, I'll go through it like four more times before I publish it in the middle of the night.
Yeah.
But if I get my edit done at midnight, I'm hitting publish. I'm looking through it. I'm like, you know what? If there's a mistake out there, someone will point it out. Like if I, you know, sometimes when you think your edit's done and you've accidentally picked up a block and moved it in front of another block because you think, and I'm like, I can't look at this anymore. I've jammed through it. You edit in sections, like you watch this 3 minutes over and over and over again, and you're like, okay, that's done. Let me go to another 3 minutes, and then you hope that you didn't accidentally rearrange something by like the side of your palm drag or whatever, and then I hit publish. But if I'm done early, I go through it. I'm like, you know what? I don't really like that section there. Let me put it there. It's better to tell the story with maybe some foreshadowing or whatever. But more time.
This started because we were talking before we recorded, and David was saying he wanted to find ways to, you know, get more out of like the video production time. Mm-hmm. Do you think that's working against you in that you the time that you are buying yourself, you're reinvesting into the same amount of output? Like, do you want more output, or are you content with the number of videos, the length of videos, the quality of videos, you know, that kind of thing?
The quality of video is very important to me. Like, it is one of the things I take a lot of pride in is, I think, how well my videos are edited. And so once you get to that point, for me, I can't go backwards. I can only go forward. So I will never do a lesser edit. I want to put out more. I want to figure out a way to make more videos that don't take as much effort, but still have the same value for myself and for the audience. But I haven't figured out what that is, because the more videos I make, the crazier the projects get, the crazier the edits get. And I just think I can't go backwards. I can only go forwards.
They say less is more.
They do.
And other people say more is more. And I think those are both true in different scenarios. But if more is more and you're trying to have less, then that's bad.
It's spinning around in my head right now. Yeah. Okay, so I do want to clarify something. When I say, I think earlier I said I get fancier with the edits. That might be true, but the purpose of the video is not to have the most high production fancy edit. The purpose of the video is to make the best video that I can possibly make in that amount of time. So sometimes having more time means removing more video. It's not always about the production. It is about the best video I can make. Yeah. Yeah. And right. So sometimes it means, you know, I made 60 pieces. They're all exactly the same. I only need to show a couple minutes of that. This is going to be a short video. That's okay. I don't need to keep adding more creative footage. Creativity doesn't always mean more creative doesn't always mean more better.
I can identify with that. Every single time I look at a video, I go, why is that in there? Get rid of that. Why is that so long? Shorten that up. Why is that so long? Speed it up. Why is that? That's the only thing I ever notice when I go back. Once in a long while, I'll watch a video for the 50th time, and then I'll be like, wait a minute. I shot something on another camera. Let me go get it. And then I plop it in. Because I forget to upload it, because if I accidentally shot it on my phone, for instance, I'm like, oh, I need this insert, and I shoot it on my phone. And then I watch the video 10 times before I publish it, and then I remember at the very last second. Oh, let me put that on. A lot of times I remember it after it's up. I'm like, there's nothing I can do about it now. I left out that insert that was on my phone or that was on my other camera that's sitting at the workshop table.
Yeah, I think what I was trying to say, and I'm sure I said it in a confusing way, was that, like, sometimes continuing to work on something and putting in continued effort, if you've got the time, sometimes that makes it better, but sometimes that actually just,
yeah,
it's just more. It's just, yeah, it's just extra effort. The end result isn't necessarily, yeah, it's not necessarily better. I mean, it may be better to you, maybe not noticeable to other people. And I think where I'm trying to get is just, what is the, not bare minimum effort. That's not what I'm talking about. What is the bare minimum good?
Yeah.
What is the point that I can put in an amount of work to something so it is good? It has a check mark, like I feel confident that it is good, but then that leaves me time to do something else good, or to do something else fun, or to do something else whatever, and not just like, it's gotta be 0.01% good, or
right,
you know, like that kind of thing.
This is why there are producers in music, because a band will work on an album forever, but a producer can come in and say, that is done, that is good enough, let's move on to the next thing. That is, it is the producer's job to be that fifth or sixth ear and say, we need to move on, that sounds great, maybe we could do that better. We don't have that. There's nobody telling us, except for deadlines, saying we need to move on.
That's gooder.
Yeah, I mean, this is all completely subjective, right? Everybody who deals with what we're talking about, this like improvement on the thing that you create, whatever it is you're creating, its final form is subjective to the creator, the person who's making the thing. So, like, whether it's good enough or too gooder or whatever is based on the person, you know. So it's not like there's a rule or a law that can be put in place that says, you know, always work this hard on this thing and then you're done or whatever. But it's just interesting to think about. I think the one...
It's a feeling.
It's a feeling, but it all the one, like, finite part of it is time. And, you know, we've talked about this a bunch of times, that just, like, that's the one thing. You're trading money for time, you're trading effort for time, and where do you want that time that you have a finite amount of to go? And, you know, so that's an entirely personal decision. For me, I have started trading my time less for work and more for other things in the last couple of years. But again, that's kind of seasonal too. I can't say that like all the time, you know. Sometimes I have to trade a lot of time for work because I need to get work done. So I don't know. That's the kind of stuff I think about. I looked up Parkinson's Law because I wanted to say it correctly. Work expands to fill the available time. That's Parkinson's Law.
Mm-hmm. I think
so. Parkinson could be our producer. And,
yeah, you know, for sure.
Yeah, if you give yourself like 20 years since I've read time, it, and that's it.
It's been like 20 years since I read it, but I think The 4-Hour Workweek by Tim Ferriss is basically all about that. You can, you have 40 hours to do your job. You fill that 40 hours. You can probably do it in 4 hours. Here's how.
Interesting. I've always wondered what that was, like what the central idea of that book was, because I've never read it.
Yeah.
Cool. All right. Oh, wait. Oh, I almost had it. It was right in front of my face. No, that's 8. I actually did one while you were talking one time. Dang it, stupid bug. Anyway, cool. Any other thoughts on this? Anything? Anything? No. Anything? No? Okay.
Just gotta look for those windows.
Yeah.
Use them to your advantage.
Well, big thanks to our Patreon supporters, as always. Super grateful for everybody over there that supports the show, that makes it possible. Very much so. Always... always want to say an extra thank you, goodness, to the top supporters, because they really do go above and beyond. So big thanks to Nick. I'm waiting for you to do it again. Nick Ryan. Okay. All right. I'm going to start over completely thanking our Patreon supporters, because I've goofed it up many times. Big thanks to everybody at all the different levels at Patreon that support the show. We are grateful for all of it.
Thank you,
These
everybody.
Top supporters go above and beyond, and we're especially grateful for them. We want to call out their names. That's Nick Ryan, Corey Ward, Albers Woodworks, Works by Solo, Chad from Maincrafting, Chad's Custom Creations, Rich at Low End Design, Odin Leather Goods, Sean Beckner, Scott at Dad It Yourself DIY, Jeff at the New Janky Workshop, Warren Works, Michael Menegin, Crabtree Creative, and Matthias Garnow. So big thanks to all them. I apologize that I'm stuttering all over myself. But we're really grateful for all of you all. And you all get the after show.
Yeah.
And I have a timely update on the Land Cruiser.
Oh, boy.
That I'm going to talk about it in the after show. So, if you want to get that after show, if you want to help us out, support the show, we would be grateful. You can go to patreon.com/makingit. Join up at any level. We would appreciate it. Thank you very much. Also, we've gotten several notes from people on Patreon, because we read the comments that come in, messages that come in through there, about the Making It 500 meetup. Had a lot of input. Mm. So I'm going to fill you guys in on that input that you've probably not seen, and we'll do that in the after show.
Okay.
Cool.
Making It 500 cruises. One-night cruise. Out of Manhattan.
Out of Manhattan.
No, I'm joking. That would be the worst.
Yeah. You guys got anything to recommend this week?
I do. Yeah. Okay. I just discovered this channel, and I freaking love it, and I wish there were more videos. It's called Hark, and she does, like, old retro stuff. Pasting the link here so you guys can check this out. She will play, like, old computer games and review them. Her latest video is Microsoft ads were weirder than you remember, and she goes progressively through Microsoft ads from the 90s and how they got more weird, and she's hilarious, and she has a good perspective on 90s tech, and it just, that's when I got my first computer that was mine. So I remember Windows 3.1 or whatever it was, and getting these CD-ROMs and playing with the Windows sound recorder. So it's makes me feel all warm and nostalgic.
Mm-hmm. I'm sending you guys a video. Have you guys, Bob Dylan put this song out about 4 years ago, 5 years ago. And I've been on a Bob Dylan kick, just randomly listening to whatever the computer serves me, because I just always have it on random, his whole catalog. But have you guys ever heard the song Murder Most Foul?
Bob Dylan wrote. I don't believe so.
It's a 17-minute song, and it's more of like a spoken poetry, but it's intense. It's like he's taken the last 30 years or the last 60 years. Well, I should rephrase that. He's taken like the 30 years from the moment JFK was killed and turned it into a spoken word poem. It's insane. Hmm. If anybody has, I happened to be listening to NPR the day that it was put out, so I knew about it, but it was served up to me yesterday, and I just was like, wow, what an intense song. I was on a long drive, and it just played the whole time. If you're a Bob Dylan fan, listen to Murder Most Foul, a song I can't remember if he recorded it in the 70s or the 80s, or if he recorded it in the 2000s. I did a quick Google search to figure that out, but it was released about 5 years ago. It's a pretty intense song. It's about the murder of JFK, and it's insane. It really pulls at your heartstrings, the whole song.
I saw Bob Dylan perform earlier this year, and it said the show started at 8. He was playing at exactly 8 o'clock, and then there was no
opener. He got no time for that.
And the funny thing is, as soon as the show was over, we started to walk out, and you could see his bus was leaving within like 10 minutes when the show was over. I'm like, he's an old man now. He doesn't have time to hang out and play around. He's got napping to do. Yeah.
I saw Bob Dylan live at a high school. I don't know why this was. It was like a benefit show in the 80s. I can't remember how I ended up there, but it was horrible. He was so bad. He was not in the mood to sing. So bad. But I'm glad I got a chance to say I could see him. And then that being said, the Grateful Dead just announced like 79 shows at the Sphere in the spring. And Rachel wants to go because she's a big Deadhead. But I said, the only way I'll go is if Bob Dylan shows up as a special guest. So... It was kind of a joke. It was a deal we made. Yeah. She's like, I think she, we'll see. I'll probably end up going.
Hmm.
Dead & Co. at the Sphere if Bob Weir makes it that far. March, April, May.
I don't have anything to recommend. I'm like looking back at my history. I'm several months back, and I don't really watch a whole lot of stuff. I have nothing interesting. Feel like I should see something here. Okay, we'll do this one. This is the Ode to Joy by the Muppets. It's Beaker doing Ode to Joy. It's awesome. So, Merry Christmas, everybody.
Is Ode to Joy, who is that? Is that Bach? Who is that?
Yeah.
You're impressed that I knew that, right?
Yeah, I'm pretty impressed.
I'm impressed that I knew that. It was one of those Jeopardy guesses.
Cool. Well, I guess that's it for this week, unless you guys got anything else.
No, thank you.
Cool. Thank you.
Thanks for listening, everybody, and we'll catch you next time.
Love you.
Love you.